Hello, and welcome to the seventh installment of Leaders and Roles virtual discussion series.
Today we are joined by Massachusetts Secretary of Education, Jim Pizer.
We hope you enjoy the discussion.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Leaders and Roles virtual discussion series. Today we are fortunate enough to be joined by Jim Pizer, the Massachusetts Secretary of Education. Secretary Pizer, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Would you be able to give us a brief overview of your career?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So I guess first thing is I didn't plan on ending up here. I didn't sort of set out early in life to become Secretary of Education. I wasn't even really planning on being in education at all. Not only did I grow up in New York, now Massachusetts, but I didn't study education. I didn't pursue teaching. I didn't work in schools. My dad was a former congressman, however, who served on the Education and Labor Committee. So I grew up knowing something about education policy as a kid. When I moved to Boston, sort of in my 20s, mostly following my girlfriend, now my wife, I came to work actually in the electronics industry, and in particular for a company that was located in Boston in the South End, sort of between the South End and Chinatown. I lived in the South End and would walk to work, and on my way would pass what was then known as Boston High School. And one day I just decided, for no particular reason other than just to get involved, to volunteer as a tutor there. And I guess you could say that one thing led to another from that. More specifically, as I spent more time in Boston schools, I began to see that the problems of urban education weren't always about money or class size, the things that you usually hear about. At Boston High, class sizes were small, often 10 students or fewer, but the level of instruction was sometimes kind of non-existent. In other words, things like school culture, high expectations, effective teaching, accountability for results, things that aren't really directly related to spending, but to practice, were essential for school and for ultimately for student success. And it was through that lens that I started to get more deeply involved in education policy, first as a volunteer, and then as a job, when I joined the Pioneer Institute to start up their Charter School Resource Center in 1993, which also happened to be the year that the Education Reform Act was signed. From there, I was appointed to the State Board of Education by Governor Weld, ultimately became chair of the board in 1999, and served in that capacity for a little over 7 years. And in 2003, I joined an organization called the New Schools Venture Fund, which is a nonprofit grant-making organization that identified and supported education entrepreneurs working in high-need, low-income neighborhoods. And I did that for a number of years, left New Schools in 2015 to join the Baker administration. Here I am.
So having served in Massachusetts Department of Education under Governors Weld, Swift, and Romney, how have you seen Massachusetts education policy grow, and how have we improved over all these years?
Well, as I said, in 1993, when I started working in this area, that was the year the Education Reform Act itself was signed. And that was really sort of a watershed moment in terms of the way the state, at least, interacted with local communities around education, both in terms of funding and in terms of setting standards, in terms of establishing sort of accountability for results measures, and had an impact, I think, in terms of the way schools operated on the ground and teachers sort of did their work in the classrooms. It's not to say that the Education Reform Act and public policy at a state level changed everything. It certainly didn't. And there was a lot that was going well and a lot of results that were very strong in Massachusetts even before 1993. But I think what you saw is a more coherent approach to education, one that was more grounded fully in high expectations for all children, standards that were pegged to sort of what were considered to be world-class levels of educational experience and curriculum. Assessments, obviously, in terms of student achievement. So there was a way to evaluate not just how individual students were doing, but how students were doing in one school versus another, in one district versus another. So there was a way to kind of level set performance across the entire state and to try to, at the same time, focus our attention much more on those districts, communities, and students where those results indicated that we had significant gaps in learning in particular in low-income communities and communities of color. So I think all of that over the course of the last, now 27 years really sort of intensified our focus on closing achievement gaps, intensified our efforts and coordinated our efforts across state and local levels to make sure we were doing everything we can for those children and young people. And I think it has produced some significant positive results. We are now, I think as most people would recognize, probably the highest performing state in the country when it comes to education, K-12 in particular. We weren't that way when this all began. And I think most people would say that the reason we were able to move in that direction and accomplish that that level of performance is because of that coordinated effort, those high expectations and high standards kind of across the entire system. But at the same time, it's really a tribute to our teachers and the sort of high quality of preparation that they've had, their just general level of talent and skill and experience, and obviously the hard work of our students in sort of rising to those higher expectations.
So kind of based on that, what do you think are some of the most important informative factors in a child's education, and then how does Massachusetts deliver on those?
Well, obviously there are many factors that go into a child's education, both educational and social. And we sometimes try to separate them out into sort of separate or discrete pieces, but it's really sort of the thoughtful, well-integrated packaging of all those experiences during, you know, a child's school experience that helps children develop into healthy, productive, and hopefully happy adults. Nevertheless, there are some things that are probably more important than others. And the one that I would focus on is early literacy. It's well known that if children don't learn to read by the third or the fourth grade, that they'll likely struggle both in school and beyond. And yet, only about half of our third or fourth graders can read proficiently. And of course, those numbers are unfortunately much worse in low-income communities and with children of color. So although we're first in the nation when it comes to academic achievement, including in reading, we are failing far too many children. And a big part of that is that we're, you know, our approach to teaching reading in those early years, both in preschool and into our first through third and fourth grade, is inconsistent in some cases, not sort of addressing some of the highest needs in the right ways. In particular, I think in terms of teaching all students how to sound out words through systematic phonics instruction, identifying students early on who are falling behind their peers so they can get extra help, and ensuring that young children are reading themselves and are hearing adults read a broad cross-section of challenging texts that will build their background knowledge and vocabulary. And so unless we're really focused on making sure those opportunities are available to all children at that critical time in their development, unfortunately, we're setting too many kids up for, you know, a very difficult road ahead. So that's the one area I think that we really need to do better than we are doing, notwithstanding the success that we've had.
So on a different note, obviously the COVID-19 pandemic has affected students in Massachusetts in a significant way this school year. We were wondering what the state did to help facilitate the shift this spring to distance learning, and what more we should do to help teachers this fall, regardless of how the school year plays out. I think you're muted.
Sorry, thank you. It's a good question. Unfortunately, I gotta say that we were all scrambling this spring. No one saw this coming. And so when it did come, both at a state and a local level, it took us a while to kind of figure out not only how long this was going to last, but how we would need to respond. And because of that, I think, you know, our success this spring was a mixed bag, to say the least. You know, a couple of things that I think the state did and the commissioner and the department did sort of out of the box was to try to clarify what the initial focus should be, particularly in making sure that children were safe and that their basic needs were being met. So instead of just trying to pivot and say, okay, let's just sort of get right back into instruction as fully as we can, I think the response was, let's make sure kids are okay and their families are okay, and then sort of come back to the teaching and learning that obviously became and still is a critical priority. Second thing was to provide guidance for teachers that instead of sort of pressing ahead with the curriculum and covering, you ought to go deeper to material that was already covered, in part because we were still in the process, and to a great extent still are, in developing those materials that would enable us to cover new material going forward in a remote context. But also, again, to get sort of students back into a rhythm of learning in a different context in their homes or in other environments that are unusual for them. And then later on to begin covering new material as we got further into the school year, and it became clear that students were not going back. We were not going to be reopening school during the spring. There was additional guidance around grading, and that many courses were just sort of credit, non-credit, as opposed to graded. There was relaxation in terms of the number of school days that schools had to be open for instruction, or at least that students had to be engaged in instruction, and there was some relaxation in terms of the state graduation requirements, specifically related to MCAS. Going forward, what we did this spring is definitely not good enough, especially the extent that remote learning will remain in some form or fashion part of the experience in the fall. So we're offering a lot more guidance to schools on school operations, including remote learning. There's a requirement now for detailed plans that are being developed as we speak that include fully going back to school, hybrid situations where students may be in school or out of school on some kind of staggered schedule, or if necessary, fully remote instruction, especially in cases if the virus in certain communities comes back in a more intensive way. We're also, through the governor's leadership, allocating something close to $1 billion in new funds, mostly federal resources that have come to the state through the so-called CARES Act, to provide support for COVID-related expenses associated with reopening, including, importantly, a $25 million matching grant program to close technology gaps in terms of devices like Chromebooks, as well as connectivity, hotspots, other things like that. And then beyond that, there are some new initiatives that are underway to provide access to or greater access to online learning platforms, to offer more professional development for teachers and school leaders, to develop curriculum materials and lesson plans that are optimized for remote learning, and a variety of other things that hopefully we'll be able to get at least partially in place as school begins, but strengthen as we go throughout the fall and in the remainder of the school year. At the end of the day, hopefully we'll get back to something that looks like school as we knew it before COVID. But none of us are sure when that's going to fully happen. And even after it does, I think what we've gone through so far and what we'll continue to go through in the fall will accelerate the trend towards using technology as a more important and regular tool of learning to differentiate instruction among students and to expand access to learning opportunities outside the schoolhouse and beyond the regular school year. So throughout the year, whether you're at home, whether you're in school, whether it's the summer, or whether it's the fall or spring. So I think actually for the better, I'm hopeful for the better, that when we're on the other side of this, school will actually be more effective, there'll be more opportunities for students, and the experience will be a better one. But there's going to be some struggle we're going to have to go through before we get there.
So on that same note, how do you see the pandemic changing the way our education system works going forward and in the eventual post-COVID world?
Well, again, I do think virtual learning, remote learning, more technology-based instruction is going to be part of the new normal and not just something that's either an add-on to the regular school day or something that is done in some places but not in others. I think at this point, it's pretty clear that schools not only need to be prepared for events like this, although hopefully we're not going to have pandemics, every few years, but they need to be prepared for situations like this. But more important, they need to integrate these tools and systems and materials into the regular school day in a way that they probably haven't before, or is only happening in a few places really well. And again, I think, as I mentioned before, there's a real upside to this in terms of being able to deliver instruction to students, not only when they need it and where they need it, but also in a way that's targeted specifically to their needs and that is flexible enough so that teachers and parents and other and students themselves can take more control of their own learning in a way that will accelerate their development. And hopefully, and put them in a place at the end of the day that sets them up really for success, both in school beyond K-12 and also for their careers.
So kind of back on the same note as technology and the access to it, we're based in Lowell and there's a lot of, it can be a lot of unequal opportunity to access technology like that. How are you gonna use the grant to make sure it's all evenly allocated to the people who really need it?
Well, the funds that we're putting out, the $25 million in particular, the matching grant program, which then ends up being $50 million of investment, is specifically designed to address those communities and those neighborhoods and those students that either lack connectivity or lack sufficient access to devices so that they can engage fully in their learning, again, not only during this current period, but going forward as well. So, part of it is just ensuring that we are targeting those resources where they're needed the most. I think beyond that, as I said earlier, we need to provide more statewide access to online learning or remote learning platforms, tools, and systems, so that regardless of where students are in the Commonwealth, regardless of what school they're going to, they and their families have access to learning resources, online and remote learning resources, that they may not have otherwise had access before, or maybe couldn't afford. So I think it's some combination of those things that hopefully will close some of these sort of digital divides that exist around the state.
So according to Boston-based nonprofit Project Bread, around 400,000 kids in the state rely on school lunches for half of their daily nutrients or more. So given everything going on with school closures and the massive uncertainty surrounding the 2020 to 2021 school year, what can schools and nonprofits and the government and community members be doing to help address this issue?
So this is potentially or hopefully, again, one of these good news, bad news stories of this whole period we're going through, because when schools close, I think as you all are well aware, and certainly was true in Lowell, food distribution became really a community-wide project with schools as a central partner. And schools have always been involved in addressing issues of food insecurity, but really only within the confines of the school year. I shouldn't say that quite so much. In the confines of the school building, and mostly within the confines of the school year and a little bit in the context of some summer food programs. But I think what happened over the course of the last several months, what's still happening now, is a much closer partnership between schools and community-based organizations to ensure that we are addressing sort of the food insecurity needs as well as other needs of all our families in all of our communities in a way that really wasn't the case before, or was just not something that people worked on before. So I think we just need to make sure we continue to exercise that muscle going forward, not just to respond to emergencies like this pandemic, but to provide a stronger food safety net for all of our families.
So kind of on a similar note to that, Massachusetts is on par with national statistics as far as high school mental health issues. How can we as a state provide more resources in and out of school for those who need them?
So, I mean, this is a broader question than schools, obviously, goes beyond, the work that I'm responsible for directly. But clearly schools play a critical role in the social and emotional development of young people as well as their mental health. It's clear that there are ways and need to be better ways for us to improve the way in which families and young people interact with the mental health system, with the public health system generally, whether they're in school or whether they're out of school. And certainly there's been, as a result of this period, there has been not only a recognition that there are big gaps in that system, but also I think some beginning steps to improve the way in which the mental health system, the health system generally, can interact with people in a virtual or remote way that may actually increase the frequency with which services can be provided, and to some extent reduce their costs as well, and therefore make them more affordable. But I think one of the big takeaways for me is that while there may be important steps that can be taken to improve the quality of mental health supports and services virtually, there's really no substitute for these in-person relationships. And that's why it's going to be so important for us to bring children back to school safely, because not only is it important for their education, but for their social, emotional development and their mental health needs. They really need to have human, in-person, face-to-face contact, not only so that problems can be identified early and addressed early, but also just to maintain that level of relationships that really does support healthy development from a mental health point of view, as well as just from a social development point of view.
So we asked some of our followers to submit questions, and the most frequently asked one is, do you think virtual learning is better or worse for the mental and overall health of students? And then how do we weigh those risks against those presented by the pandemic?
So this is the big question, right, that we're all wrestling with, and there's no easy answer to it. I think there are definitely some benefits to virtual learning, and I've talked a little bit about some of them already. One is obviously you don't have to be in a particular place to get access to learning opportunities. Another is there may be resources that you can access through a virtual platform that you would never be able to get in your own school, and experiences that you can have virtually that, again, are not easily recreated in the school context. And also that we've learned, I think, through the course of the last few months, that even sort of interactions, person-to-person interactions or group interactions, can be effectively done online. Having said that, as I said earlier, there really is no substitute for face-to-face and in-person instruction and the relationships that develop as a result of that. So while we need to get better at virtual learning and remote learning, and it needs to become and will become more of a standard part of our educational delivery system, we have to recognize that education is ultimately a human enterprise, which requires human face-to-face, in-person interaction, engagement, and relationship. So again, we need to, as you've indicated, as the question indicates, we need to be vigilant about the virus and the emerging science about how it's transmitted, how it can be contained. But I have a growing confidence that as we learn more, we're able to kind of create the right context and the right circumstances that with the right supports can enable us to bring students and schools safely back to school where I think they need to be for everyone's benefit.
So aside from the coronavirus, there is an epidemic of student loan debt around the country. And here in Massachusetts, the UMass system is one of the best yet also most expensive college systems in the country with 5 tuition increases in the last 5 years. How do you think colleges can work to reduce costs and still help students be able to afford to continue their education?
Well, this is a big question. I'm sure it's weighing on everyone's minds. It's even more challenging, you know, in this environment as everything is. But it is a long-term issue that we need to address. There's another part of this which will exacerbate the problem you're talking about, and that's that from a demographic point of view, we are reaching sort of the peak and actually probably have gone past the peak of our traditional college-going age population. So students, you know, 18 to 25 years old, that population is declining in the Northeast, Massachusetts included. And that means that colleges are having a harder time ensuring that they are fully enrolled. And if they're not fully enrolled, that exacerbates the financial pressures that they're under, which in turn causes them to look towards increasing tuition and fees in order to cover those potential losses. So the combination of these things, and then obviously adding on top of it the additional costs associated with COVID and trying to reconfigure campuses and de-densify, as they say, dormitories and school buildings in order to ensure safety, all of that is just adding to the cost burdens that schools, colleges are under. So it's challenging times. So that's, I don't want to pretend that it's not. But I think there are a few things that we need to do. One, obviously, is just the question of the level of investment in higher education itself. And this is, a big issue, especially in the context of a pretty tough fiscal situation that we're going into and trying to balance our investment in K-12, which is increasing significantly as a result of the adoption of the Student Opportunity Act, with trying to increase investment as well in our higher education system, as well as early education for that matter. So we need to sort of think about just the overall level of investment that we're making in higher education. But even in the context of those constraints, I think we need to be more strategic about our use of financial aid to make sure that we are applying those resources to the students who need them the most and in a way that encourages completion and not just course taking. Because one of the things that is so problematic is that you know, literally 50 to 60% of, oh, I should say 40 to 50% of our students who go to college don't complete within 6 years. And therefore what they're doing is they're incurring debt and they're not getting that credential. So that's sort of the worst of both worlds. So we need to make sure that we're using financial aid in a way that incentivizes and encourages students to complete and encourages colleges and universities to support their students in completing. And then the next thing is, you know, we just need to come up with more ways to bend the cost curve. Because as much as the the burden that students are bearing is going up, it's really, you know, as a result, in part, a result of financial pressures associated with, you know, the state aid or some of the sort of limitations on state aid. It's also a function of the increasing costs on the ground for delivering really the same kind of educational product. And so we need to do more. The colleges and universities need to do more to be more effective and more coordinated in terms of their planning process, in particular, and to encourage greater collaboration with other institutions of higher education within their region across the state, so they're not duplicating administrative costs, educational costs, so that we're being smarter and more acting more like a system of education rather than just a bunch of individual campuses. And we need to sort of start thinking about a somewhat less is more approach to the course catalog and degree programs that colleges offer. There's been, you know, over the course of time, a proliferation of degree programs and courses, which means that each course, each degree program is serving fewer students and therefore not creating the critical mass that allows you to have some savings by having more concentrated enrollment in those programs and courses. So thinking again about, trying to consolidate the offerings in a way that's smart, that's addressing the needs of students and of the economy and of employers, but is not sort of a full-on buffet or cafeteria so that every student has access to kind of an infinite number of options. And then finally, back to the subject we've been talking about really all morning here, is making more effective use of online instruction. So one of the things that higher education is certainly learning, even more so probably than the folks in K-12, is how to use online instruction smartly, how to use it in a way that's complementary to in-person instruction, so that you are bringing students into classes, into labs, into simulation environments or in-person environments when they need to, but enabling them to take courses online and to take parts of courses online, either synchronously, meaning as they're being delivered, or asynchronously in a recorded format or some competency-based format, which allows them to engage on their own schedule. That doing that smartly, I think, not only can lower costs, but it can actually improve the quality of the educational experience and improve access for more students to those experiences in ways that currently are just impossible in a traditional bricks and mortar, traditional calendar, school calendar setting. So anyway, I think there's a lot more we can do around trying to bend that cost curve, contain costs, so that we're reducing the cost to students and families.
So we've touched on this a bit before earlier on, but Massachusetts is consistently ranked as having the best K-12 public education system in the country. So what do we do differently than other states, and how have we maintained those high standards for so long?
It's hard to answer that question. On the one hand, we were probably lucky, so we shouldn't dismiss that. On the other hand, I think we did some things right at the beginning back in 1993. And importantly, we stuck to it. And that's what a lot of other states, I think, didn't do over the course of time. They didn't necessarily sort of set the bar at the right level or do the right things that we did in terms of setting standards, in terms of aligning our assessments to those standards, creating accountability systems that incentivized or encouraged high levels of expectations for students and staff and schools, didn't necessarily fund their schools in a way that we did with a progressive funding formula that ensured that lower income, higher need communities got more state funding. There are a bunch of things, again, that we did right that other states maybe didn't quite do as well. But probably more important is we stuck with it and have stuck with it over the course of now over 25 years. And other states have vacillated back and forth, raising standards, lowering standards, changing standards, all that noise, I think, has had significant has created significant problems for them in maintaining continuous improvement over time. And for us, I think importantly, that's meant that education reform has been this bipartisan enterprise. And I know in a current environment, it's almost impossible to imagine what bipartisanship is or was. But actually, we've had, you know, Republican governors and Democratic governors in partnership with Democratic legislatures, whether you've had a Democratic governor or a Republican governor, all sort of committed to the same basic approach. And it hasn't always been easy, and there's certainly been disagreements along the way. But because of that bipartisan consensus, the Board of Education, the Department of Education, the schools and districts throughout the Commonwealth have had a clear sense of where they're heading and what they need to do, and have been able to persist and invest in the work that needs to be done day in and day out in schools to help students achieve. So I think it's been that bipartisan consensus and that persistence over time that's really made all the difference.
So what do you think students and teachers can do to be more proactive about their own learning and making their school community better for themselves and others?
Well, that's a broad question. I'm not sure exactly there's really an answer to it, other than, you know, the point that is sort of underlying the question is that educators and students need to take ownership and responsibility for themselves and their school and their classrooms and their students and their schools. In order to make all this work. It doesn't happen by itself. It happens with a real commitment to education as a core value of what it means to be a citizen and what it means to be a Commonwealth that is serving all the people and that is helping to uplift all the people. That's really has more to do with kind of culture, both school culture and broader social culture. I think we're lucky in Massachusetts where education is highly valued. People do recognize that it's not only an individual responsibility, but a shared responsibility. And we just need to keep reinforcing that. You know, one of the things that we did in the last couple of years and that is now beginning to play out in schools around the Commonwealth, although maybe not as fast because of what's gone on over the last few months, is the implementation of a full year civics course in middle school, typically in eighth grade. And I think that, you know, we need to start looking at that course as a sort of an anchor for not only engaging students in a deeper understanding of what it means to be an American and a citizen of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, but also in being a good citizen and being a good contributor to society as a whole, including and importantly based on their educational experience as individuals and the importance that they need to place on the education of their own children and of their communities as the bedrock for a healthy and democratic society. So hopefully these things are kind of reinforcing themselves, and hopefully we won't lose sight of that in Massachusetts, notwithstanding what's going on in the rest of the country.
So last question. Throughout your career, you've worked to help educate the next generation of leaders. Through this work, what have you learned about leadership and education and beyond?
Wow. Okay. Maybe I need like an hour to go off and think about this, but instead I'll give you what comes to the top of my head. I think, and this is true in education probably as much as or more than in any other sort of sector of our society. At the end of the day, it's a group collaborative project. And so leadership, to the extent that it is designed to tell people what to do rather than work with people to find the right solutions, that kind of leadership is going to ultimately fail. There is no question that, especially in large scale, complex systems or almost non-systems like our public education system, that at a senior level, whether it's at a governor level or at a secretary level or a commissioner or board of education, there's some tough decisions that need to get made and some choices about directions that need to be set, and not everyone's going to be happy about those things. But at the same time, it's clear that coming up with a great policy or a great plan without great execution is, you know, a dead end. And the only way you get great execution is to get people to buy in, to get people to understand, to get people to commit to doing the hard work day in and day out over an extended period of time. And again, that requires working with people rather than telling them what to do. But that sort of works both ways, meaning sometimes there is a need for folks in the schools themselves or on the ground to be collaborative, if you will, with people who are sort of in my role at the state level and a leadership level at the state. And so there needs to be this mutuality of good faith, if you will, to try to work together and not to try to just fight things out in an antagonistic way and, you know, everyone trying to get everything and not try to find some common ground. This, you know, sort of sounds like the prior question about, you know, how do we come together as a society around some of these issues? But in education, it unfortunately can sometimes be a highly polarized and polarizing environment. And I think we just, you know, although it's a cliche, we need to, regardless of whether you're at a state level or a local level, whether you're, you know, in a school or in a bureaucracy, need to constantly be thinking about how do we do what's in the best interests of students and children and their families and their communities, and how do we do it in a way that is kind of going to create the least noise but create the most progress. And that's, you know, easier said than done always, but as long as we're going into it with that kind of attitude, trying to find out what works and do more of it, and not try to view these things as sort of ideological struggles, I think we're gonna be okay. But leadership that relies on kind of command and control or ideological purity is not gonna succeed. Certainly not in this, not in the context of public education.
So that is all the time we have for today. And so we'd just like to thank our partners, America's Promise Alliance, Nancy Donahue, and the Greater Lowell Community Foundation for their support. Thank you to all our listeners and viewers, and most importantly, thank you to Secretary Pizer for being with us today.
Thank you both, and thanks to everyone who's watching.
We hope you enjoyed our discussion with Secretary Pizer.
To learn more about Leaders in Lowell, please check out our website at leadersinlowell.org and our Instagram at leadersinlowellofficial. Stay up to date with our social media accounts and our website to hear all about our upcoming events, including an upcoming discussion with Jasmine Grace, a human sex trafficking survivor, and members of the Lincoln Project.
Again, thank you, Secretary Pizer, and all of you for tuning in. We hope to see you again soon.